Irene. She wakes up face down on a beach. Someone is calling her name. Irene! She lifts her head and feels her cheek and lips dusted with sand so white and fine, it might be powdered sugar. Irene can sense impending clouds. As the sun disappears, it gains a white-hot intensity. It's like a laser cutting through her. The next instant, she feels the lightest sprinkling of rain. Irene! She sits up. The beach is unfamiliar, but it's tropical. There's turquoise water before her, lush vegetation behind, a rooster and two hens strutting around. She must be back on St. John. How did she get here?
Irene!
A man is calling her name. She can see a figure moving toward her. The rain starts to fall harder now, with intention. The tops of the palm trees sway. Irene dashes for the cover of the tree canopy and wishes for a towel to wrap around her naked body. Naked? That's right. She forgot to pack a swimsuit. The man is growing closer, still calling her name.
Irene! Irene!
She doesn't want him to see her. She tries to cover up her nakedness by hunching over and crossing her arms strategically. It feels like an impossible yoga pose. She's shivering now. Her hair is wet. Her braid hangs like a soggy rope down her back. The man is waving his arms as if he's drowning. Irene scans the beach. Someone else will have to help him because she certainly can't. But there's no one around. No boats on the horizon, and even the chickens are gone. There will be a confrontation, she supposes. So she needs to prepare. She studies the approaching figure. Irene opens her mouth and tries to scream. Does she scream? If so, she can't hear herself. It's Russ. She wipes the rain out of her eyes. Russell Steele, her husband of 35 years, is slogging toward her through the wet sand, looking as though he has something urgent to tell her.
Irene!
He's close enough now for her to see him clearly. The silvering hair, the brown eyes. He has a suntan. He's had a constant tan since he started working for Todd Croft at Ascension 13 years ago. Their friends used to tease Russ about it, but Irene barely noticed, much less questioned it. He was on business in Florida and Texas. The tan seemed logical. She had chalked it up to lunch meetings at outdoor restaurants, endless rounds of golf. How many times had Russ told her he would be unreachable because he'd be playing golf with clients? Now, of course, Irene knows better.
Irene,
he says. His voice frightens her. She digs her heels into the sand. Russ's white tuxedo shirt is so soaked that she can see the flesh tone of his skin beneath. His khaki pants are split up one leg. He looks like he's survived a shipwreck. No, Irene thinks, not a shipwreck. A plane crash. A helicopter crash, that's it. Russ, she says. He's getting pummeled by rain, and Irene flashes back 20 years to a Little League game of Baker's that was suspended due to a violent Midwestern thunderstorm. All the parents huddled in the dugout with the kids, but Russ, in a show of gallantry, ran out onto the field to collect the equipment. Another father, Steve Sonnet, Irene had always rather disliked Steve Sonnet, said, "Reckless of him, picking up those metal bats. He's going to get himself killed." There was another time she remembers Russ soaking wet, a wedding in Atlanta. The Dunn's daughter, Maisie, was marrying an executive at Delta Airlines. This was 5 or 6 years ago, back when Irene and Russ found themselves attending more weddings than they had even when they were young. The reception was held at Rhodes Hall, and when she and Russ emerged from the strobe-lit dance floor and martini bar, it was to a downpour. Again, Russ insisted on playing the hero by tenting his tuxedo jacket over his head and dashing across the parking lot to their rental car. When he'd pulled up to the entrance a few moments later, His shirt had been soaked through, just like this one is now.
The storm, Russ says, is coming.
Well, yes, Irene thinks. That much is obvious.
It's a proper deluge now, and the darkest clouds are still moving toward them.
I thought you were dead, she says. They told me... She stops. She's speaking, but she can't hear herself. It's frustrating. They told me you were dead.
It will be a bad storm, Russ says. Destructive.
Where should we go? Irene asks. She turns to face the trees. Where do the chickens hide from the rain, she wonders. Because she would like to hide there too.
At 8 o'clock on the dot, Irene wakes Cash. He has started calling her Mother Alarm Clock.
I had another dream, she says.
Cash props himself up on his elbows in bed. His blonde hair is messy and he's growing a beard. He hasn't shaved since they left the island. Irene has put him in the grandest of her 5 guest rooms, the Excelsior Suite, she calls it. It has dark, raised panel walls with a decorative beveled edge at the chair rail and an enormous Eastlake bed with a fringed canopy. There's also a stained glass transom window that Irene got for a steal at a tiny antiques shop in Solon, Iowa, and a silk Persian rug in burgundy and cream that Irene had purchased from a licensed dealer in Chicago. She'd thought Russ might veto a 5-figure rug, but he told her to go ahead, get it, whatever made her happy. Irene's favorite piece in the room is a wrought iron washstand that holds a ceramic bowl edged in gold leaf. Above it hangs a photograph of Russ's mother, Millie, as a young girl in Erie, Pennsylvania, in 1928. Irene remembers the joy and pride she'd felt in refurbishing this room, every room in the house, really. But at this instant, she can't understand why. The Victorian style seems so heavy, so overdone, so tragic. Irene has abandoned the master bedroom. She will never be able to sleep there again. Since she returned from St. John, she's been using the smallest guest room, originally meant to be quarters for a governess. It's up on the 3rd floor, across from the attic. The attic is crammed with the bargains Irene scored at flea markets but couldn't find a place for in the house, along with all the furniture from their former home, since Russ refused to let her take it to Goodwill. Russ had remarked many times that he would have been just as happy staying in their modest ranch on Clover Street, and Irene had thought him crazy. Of course, that was before she realized that Russ had a second life elsewhere. The governess's room had been all but neglected in the renovation. Irene had simply painted the walls sky blue and furnished it with a white daybed and a small shaker dresser. Now she appreciates the room's simplicity and its isolation. She feels like she's safe there, although she can't seem to hide from these dreams.
Dad was alive? Cash asks.
Alive, Irene says. This is the 3rd such dream she's had since returning from St. John. Irene and Cash and Irene's older son, Baker, all traveled down to the Virgin Islands upon receiving the news that Russ had been killed in a helicopter crash off the coast of Virgin Gorda. He had been flying from a private helipad on St. John to the remote British island Anagata with a West Indian woman named Rosie Small. Irene then discovered that Rosie was Russ's lover, and that Russ had left behind a $15 million villa and a 12-year-old daughter named Maya. It was a surreal and traumatizing trip for Irene and her sons, and yet now, a week later, all of these shocking facts have been woven into the tapestry of Irene's reality. It was incredible, really, what the brain could assimilate. He was talking about a storm. A bad storm, he said. Destructive.
Maybe he meant the lightning storm, Cash says.
Maybe, Irene says.
The helicopter had been struck by lightning.
Or maybe it's what lies ahead.
The investigation, Cash says.
Yes.
The week before, Only a couple days after they'd arrived home from St. John, an FBI agent named Colette Vasco called Irene, Cash, and Baker to let them know that the Virgin Islands search and rescue team had contacted the Bureau with suspicions that there might have been more to the helicopter crash than met the eye. "What does that mean exactly?" Irene had asked. "The damage to the helicopter doesn't match up with a typical lightning strike," Agent Vasco said. "There was lightning in the area, but the damage to the helicopter seemed to be caused by an explosive device." "An explosive device," Irene said. "We're investigating further," Agent Vasco said. "What can you tell me about a man named Todd Croft?" "Next to nothing," Irene had said. She went on to explain that she had tried any number of ways to reach Todd Croft, to no avail. "I probably want to find him more than you do," Irene said. She gave Agent Vasco the number that Todd Croft's secretary, Marilyn Monroe, had called Irene from. Agent Vasco had thanked her and said she'd be back in touch. More to the helicopter crash than met the eye. An explosive device. This was turning into something from a movie, Irene thought. Yet she suspected that it was only a matter of time before the next dark door into her husband's secret life opened. "Also, there were chickens in the dream," Irene says to Cash. "A rooster and two hens." Cash clears his throat.
"Well, yeah."
"Well, yeah?" Then Irene gets it. Russ is the rooster. Irene and Rosie, the two hens. Other than Cash and Baker, no one here in Iowa City knows that Russ is dead. Irene hasn't told anyone, which feels like a huge deception, as though she stuffed Russ's corpse into one of the house's 19 closets, and now it's starting to stink. Irene quiets her conscience by telling herself it's her own private business. Besides, no one has asked. This isn't strictly true. Dot, the nurse at the Brown Deer Retirement Community, asked where Russ was, and in a moment of sheer panic, Irene lied and told Dot he was on a business trip in the Caribbean. "And he couldn't get away?" Dot asked. "Even for this?" Dot was fond of Russ. She cooed over him at his every visit as though he had forded rivers and climbed mountains to get there, although she took Irene's daily presence at Brown Deer for granted. Irene perversely enjoyed watching the shadow of disillusionment cross Dot's face when she learned that Russ had put work before his own dying mother. Russ's footprint in Iowa City all but disappeared after he took the job with Ascension 13 years ago. Russ used to know everybody in town. He worked for the Corn Refiners Association and was a social creature by nature. He would drop off Baker and Cash at school and then go to Pearson's drugstore on Lynn Street for a cup of coffee with the boys. The four or five retired gentlemen known as the Midwestern Mafia who ran Iowa City. Russ's coffee break with the boys was sacred. They were the ones who encouraged him to run for the Iowa City School Board, and they'd suggested he join the Rotary Club, where he eventually became vice president. All of the boys were now dead, and Russ hadn't been involved with local politics or the Rotary Club in over a decade. Irene occasionally bumped into someone from that previous life. Cherie Warner, for example, wife of the former superintendent of schools. Cherie, or whoever, would ask after Russ and then add, "We always knew he would make it big someday," as though Russ were a movie star or the starting quarterback for the Chicago Bears. But who from Iowa City remained in Russ's everyday life? No one, really. Now that the business of Millie's death has been handled, her body delivered to the funeral home, her personal effects collected, the probate attorney from Brown Deer enlisted to settle her estate, Irene has no choice but to face the daunting task of contacting the family attorney, Ed Sorley, to tell him about Russ.
"Irene," Ed says.
His voice contains cheerful curiosity.
"I didn't expect to hear from you again so soon. Everything okay?"
Irene is in the amethyst-hued parlor, pacing a Persian rug that the same Chicago carpet dealer who'd sold her the Excelsior suite rug had described as Queen Victoria's jewel box overturned. Irene had bought it immediately, despite the fact that it cost even more than the other rug.
"No, Ed," Irene says, "it's not."
She pauses. Russ has been dead for 10 days, and this is the first time she's going to say the words out loud to someone other than her sons. "Russ is dead." There is a beat of silence. 2 beats.
"What?"
Ed says.
"Irene, what?"
"He was killed in a helicopter crash on New Year's Day," Irene says. "Down in the Virgin Islands." She doesn't wait for Ed to ask the obvious follow-up question. What was Russ doing on a helicopter in the Virgin Islands? Or maybe, where are the Virgin Islands?
"When I called you last week to ask about Russ's will, he was already dead. I should have told you then. I'm sorry, it's just, I was still processing the news myself."
"Oh, geez, Irene," Ed says. "I'm so, so sorry. Russ," there's a lengthy pause.
"Man, Anita is going to be devastated. You know how she adored Russ. You might not have realized how all the wives in our little group way back when thought Russ was an all-star husband. Anita used to ask me why I couldn't be more like him."
Ed stops abruptly, and Irene can tell he's fighting back emotion.
"Anita should be glad you weren't more like him," Irene wants to say.
Anita and Ed Sorley were part of a group of friends Irene and Russ had made when the kids were small. And yes, Anita had been transparently smitten with Russ. She had always laughed at his jokes and was the most envious on Irene's 50th birthday, when Russ hired an airplane to pull a banner declaring his love.
"I need help, Ed," Irene says. "You're the first person I've told other than my kids. The boys and I flew down to the Caribbean last week. Russ's body had been cremated and we scattered the ashes."
"You did?" Ed says.
"So are you planning a memorial then, instead of a funeral?"
"No memorial," Irene says. "At least, not yet." She knows this will sound strange.
"I can't face everyone with so many unanswered questions. And I need to ask you, Ed, as my attorney, to please keep this news quiet. I don't even want you to tell Anita."
There was another significant pause.
"I'll honor your wishes, Irene," Ed says, "but you can't keep it a secret forever. Are you going to submit an obituary to the Press Citizen? Or, I don't know, post something on Facebook, maybe?"
"Facebook?" Irene says. The mere notion is appalling.
"Do I have a legal obligation to tell people?"
"Legal?" Ed says,
"no, but I mean, wow, you must still be in shock. I'm in shock myself, I get it. What was, why?"
"Ed," Irene says, "I called you to find out what legal steps I need to take." There's an audible breath from Ed. He's flustered. Irene imagines going through this 90 or 100 more times with every single one of their friends and neighbors. Maybe she should publish an obituary. But what would she say? 2 hours after the papers landed on people's doorsteps, she would have well-intentioned hordes arriving with casseroles and questions. She can't bear the thought.
"When I called you before, Ed, you said Russ signed a new will in September."
Irene had shoved this piece of information to a remote corner of her mind, but now it's front and center. Why the hell did Russ sign a new will without Irene and, more saliently, without telling Irene? There could only be one reason.
"You said he included a new life insurance policy? For $3 million?
She swallows.
"The life insurance policy, who's the beneficiary?"
Here is the moment when the god-awful truth is revealed, she thinks. Russ must have made Rosie the beneficiary, or maybe, if he was too skittish to do that, He made a trust the beneficiary, a trust that would lead back to Rosie and Maya.
You, of course, Ed says. The beneficiary is you.
Me? Irene says. She feels... Ed says,
who else would it be? The boys? I think Russ was concerned about Cash's ability to manage money.
Ed coughs. Russ did make one other change. After you called me last week, I checked my notes.
What was the other change?
Well, you remember that back when you and Russ signed your wills in 2012, you made Russ the executor of your will, and Russ made his boss, Todd Croft, the executor of his. In my notes, I wrote that Russ said his finances were becoming too complex for, as he put it, a mere mortal to deal with, and he didn't want to burden you with that responsibility. He said Todd would be better able to deal with the fine print. Do you remember that?
Does Irene remember that? She closes her eyes and tries to put herself in Ed Sorley's office with Russ. She definitely remembers the meeting about the real estate closing. She had been so excited. But the day that they signed their wills is lost. It had probably seemed like an onerous chore, akin to getting the oil changed in her Lexus. She knew it had to be done, but she paid little attention to it because she and Russ were in perfect health. They were finally hitting their stride. A new job for Russ, a new house, money. No, she does not remember. She doubts she would have objected to Russ making Todd Croft the executor of his will. Back then, Todd had seemed like a savior, Todd the god.
So Todd was the executor, Irene says.
And when Russ came in to sign the new will this past September, he changed it, Ed says. He made you the executor.
He did? Irene says.
Didn't he tell you? Ed says.
No, Irene says. Then she wonders if that's right. You know what, Ed? He might have told me, and I just forgot. Or I wasn't listening, she thinks.
It's entirely possible that back in September, Russ said one night at dinner, I saw Ed Sorley today, signed a new will with extra life insurance protection, and I made you executor.
And it's entirely possible that Irene said, okay, great.
Back in September, this information would have seemed unremarkable, even dull. Life insurance, executor, who cared? It was all preparation for an event, Russ's death, that was, if not exactly inconceivable, then very, very far in the future. Now, of course, the will has red-hot urgency. Irene is the beneficiary of the life insurance policy, and she's the executor of the will. This is good news, right?
I have something else in my notes,
Ed says, and he sounds on the verge of getting choked up again.
When I asked Russ if he was concerned that being executor might be a burden for you, considering the complicated nature of his finances, he said, Irene is the only person I trust to do the right thing.
Ed pauses.
Those were his exact words. I wrote them down.
Irene is the only person I trust to do the right thing. That seemingly simple sentence has a lot to unpack. Russ didn't trust Todd Croft to do the right thing, no surprise there. Had Russ assumed that Irene would find out about Rosie, Maya, the villa in St. John? And if the answer was yes, did he expect that Irene would have enough forgiveness in her heart to make sure that Rosie and Maya were taken care of financially? If again the answer was yes, he had given her a lot of credit. Irene sighed. Russ was right. Rosie is no longer an issue, but Irene most certainly plans on providing for Maya.
What do I do from here, Ed? Irene asks.
I'll need at least 10 copies of the death certificate, Ed says. I'd like one as soon as possible so I can start the probate process.
Where do I get a death certificate? Irene asks.
No one provided one for you? You should have been issued one from the state where Russ died.
He died in the British Virgin Islands, Irene reminds him, between Virgin Gorda and Anagata.
There's silence from Ed.
she might as well have named two moons of Jupiter. Baker was in charge of figuring out exactly who claimed the body, she tells Ed, and who performed the cremation. He had some trouble. It's apparently very hard to get a body back from another country, and it was over the holidays. The regular people were on vacation.
I'm not going to lie to you, Irene, Ed says. My experience with this is limited. But you're saying you didn't get a death certificate while you were down there?
We didn't, Irene says. Baker called the Brits, who directed him to the Americans, who sent him back to the Brits. Todd Croft had someone go down and identify the body. That was before we arrived, and he ordered the cremation without even asking me.
What?
Ed says. Irene has opened the proverbial can of worms now. She may as well keep going. Todd Croft has essentially vanished. I can't reach him or his secretary, and the Ascension webpage is down.
Jeez, Irene, Ed says. This is like something out of a movie.
Ed, Irene says, you didn't know anything about Russ's owning property in the Caribbean, did you?
In the Caribbean? Ed says. Heck no.
How much did you understand about his job? Irene asks. Did the two of you ever discuss it?
He worked for Croft's hedge fund, right? Ed says. He was the front man?
Right, Irene says. She relaxes a little. The way Russ had described it to her, the Ascension clients were investing such large amounts of money in such a high-risk environment, they needed a dedicated person just to put them at ease. And that person was Russ. Up until this very second, Irene wondered if maybe Ed Sorley was in on the whole mess. But now it's clear from his earnest tone that he's just as bewildered as she is. Ed wears sweater vests. He handles wills, trusts, real estate closings, and the occasional dispute over property lines for the farmers of Johnson County. Russ and Irene hired him for their legal matters because he's their longtime friend. Irene realizes Russ must have had a second lawyer, one provided for him by Ascension. Real estate, though.
I'll call our bank, obviously, Irene says.
They used to keep a checking and savings account at First Iowa Savings and Loan, where their friend Jerry Kinsey was the president. But shortly after Russ started working at Ascension, they switched to the behemoth Federal Republic Bank because Russ insisted that that bank was better equipped to handle Russ and Irene's change of circumstance. Irene recalls pushing back on this. Just because Russ had a shiny new job didn't mean they had to change their small-town ways, did it? Russ had looked at her like she was naive, and Irene had capitulated. They opened a joint brokerage account at Federal Republic, although Irene defiantly kept a smaller account at First Iowa in her own name. That was where her paychecks from the magazine were deposited. Now that Irene thinks about it, she realizes she never saw a balance of more than $50,000 in the Federal Republic account. They have several million invested, or so Irene has been led to believe, and the amount in the Federal Republic account was obviously replenished by Russ's paychecks and bonuses. So there should be a money trail that leads to Todd Croft and Ascension. Irene never delved into the particulars of their new financial situation because, quite frankly, she had done her share of worrying, creating budgets, stretching their meager resources for a long time, and it was a relief just to know that there was money now, so much money that Irene could take a bath in French champagne every night if she wanted. Back when Irene was renovating the house, Russ had transferred money into an account dedicated solely to paying the contractors and estate sale managers and rug dealers. But that account had been closed for a while now. We bought the house and the lot here on Church Street outright, Irene says. That money was wired to our Federal Republic account from somewhere else. Would you look into it?
I can certainly do that, Ed says. It was 7 years ago? We've gotten a whole new computer system since then, but we must still have the paperwork in a box in the attic. I'll go upstairs and check.
Thank you, Ed, Irene says.
Oh, Irene, Ed says. It's the least I can do.
Please don't say anything to Anita, Irene says again.
I'll tell people when I'm ready.
You have my word, Ed says. Your job is to get a certified copy of the death certificate. Without that, Russ is technically still alive.
Still alive, Irene thinks, just like in her dreams.
Irene's next move is a trip to Federal Republic. There's a branch in Coralville, although she has never set foot in it. She manages to find the most recent statement, which shows a balance of $46,270.32. There was a deposit of $7,500 on Monday, December 10th, and another deposit of $7,500 on Monday, December 24th, at 11 o'clock in the morning. The withdrawals are automatic payments for the household bills, electricity, cable, heating oil. There's a $3,200 payment to Citibank, that's Irene's credit card, an amount that was a little higher than normal due to Christmas. Irene approaches the teller with trepidation, even though she has never seen the young woman before. She's Asian and far younger than either Cash or Baker, which is good. Irene craves anonymity. The last thing she wants is to deal with someone who knows her family, even slightly. Irene checks the woman's nameplate, Josephine.
Good afternoon, Josephine, Irene says.
She stretches her face into a smile, but she suspects it looks like a grimace.
I have some questions about my account.
Certainly, Josephine says. She accepts the statement from Irene, then starts tapping at her computer keyboard.
Let me just bring this up on my screen.
She pauses. Her eyes grow wide.
What? Irene thinks.
She's worried she's going to be exposed on the spot. She'd have to say,
I'm here because my husband died under mysterious circumstances. I've just discovered he had a second life, but I was never suspicious because, honestly, Josephine, I paid very little attention to him. And I know next to nothing about our current financial situation.
You're a valued and trusted account holder here at Federal Republic, Josephine says. With us since 2006?
Yes, Irene says.
She points to the amounts she underlined on the statement.
I was wondering if you could tell me where these two amounts were wired from. I don't see any other account number or the name of the bank.
Josephine checks the amounts on the statement, then blinks at her screen.
You're referring to the $7,500 deposit on Monday, December 10th, and the $7,500 deposit on Monday, December 24th?
Josephine's voice is very loud, Irene thinks. She seems to be intentionally drawing attention to her teller window. Irene quickly casts a glance around the bank. She lives in mortal fear of seeing someone she knows.
Yes,
Irene whispers, trying to telegraph the delicate nature of the situation.
Those deposits were made in cash,
Josephine announces brightly.
Cash?
Irene says. She nearly adds, you mean to tell me Russ walked in here with $7,500 on his person and then did it again 2 weeks later?
Yes, cash,
Josephine says with such gusto that Irene thinks, why not just broadcast over the bank's PA system that Russell Steele was a drug dealer?
Okay, Irene says, thank you. One more quick question.
She leans in, locking eyes with Josephine, hoping that Josephine will finally understand the need for discretion.
Are there any other accounts at this bank under my name or my husband's name?
Josephine pulls back a couple of inches.
Do you have the account numbers?
I don't, Irene says.
She's trying to choose her words carefully here, though really what she's tempted to do is tell young Josephine a cautionary tale.
I let my husband take over our finances, and now I don't know what I do or don't have. I think I may have a second account here, one I haven't been keeping close tabs on. Would you be able to check using my name or my husband's name, our address, or our social security numbers?
Here, Irene slides Josephine a piece of paper with both socials clearly labeled.
I can't find any paperwork on our other accounts, but it's a new year, so one resolution I made was to figure this out. Josephine presses her lips together in a way that lets Irene know she's growing suspicious. Still, her fingers fly across the keyboard. She slows to punch the social security numbers in carefully, then waits for the results. Blood pulses in Irene's ears, and her shearling coat feels like it's made of lead.
"I don't see another account under either name or social," Josephine says. "Nothing's coming up. Would you like me to call over my branch manager?"
"No, thank you. That's okay," Irene says. "For all I know, the account I'm thinking of could be at a different bank altogether." Josephine tilts her head.
"A different bank?"
Irene backs toward the door. She can't get out of there fast enough. "Well, like I said, it's my New Year's resolution to get organized."
"All righty," Josephine says. "Good luck with that."
Ayers. Huck has asked Ayers to help him go through the things in Rosie's bedroom during the week while Maya is at school. Ayers doesn't make it up to the house on Jacob's Ladder until the Thursday before the Martin Luther King Day weekend.
"I'm sorry I didn't come sooner," Ayers says. "My life just got really busy all of a sudden."
"Don't apologize," Huck says. "You have two jobs, and now that you're back with Mick, I'm sure he wants your attention as well."
Ayers sighs. She is back with Mick, and he does want her attention. He admitted that seeing her with Baker, Mick calls him Banker, drove him crazy with jealousy, and he vowed not to let anything or anyone get between them again. Since they've been back together, Mick has stopped by La Tapa at the end of Ayers' shift each night and walked her to her truck before heading back to Beach Bar until closing. He's abandoned his usual ritual of late-night drinks at the Quiet Mon and instead drives straight to Ayers' apartment in Fish Bay, where he spends the night. When Ayers works on Treasure Island, he meets her at the customs dock at 4 o'clock with a pineapple banana smoothie from Our Market. On the one day off they've had together so far, Mick borrowed his boss's boat, and they cruised all the way up the North Shore to snorkel at Water Lemon Key. They spotted 3 basking sharks and 2 spotted eagle rays. Mick is as much of a snorkel nerd as Ayers. When they saw the 2nd spotted eagle ray rippling along the sandy bottom, Mick dived down and undulated right along top of it. When he and Ayers surfaced a few moments later, he pulled off his mask and grinned like a kid with a shiny new bike. And Ayers felt a wave of the familiar adoration. This was her guy. They'd left Water Lemon and headed to Gibney for an hour on the beach. When Ayers' stomach started to rumble, they climbed back into the boat and tied up to the dock at Keneal Bay. They strolled hand in hand, salty and sandy, to the beach bar, where Mick ordered a bottle of Moet, the conch fritters, and 4 sushi rolls. Ayers had craned her neck to ogle the hotel rooms that lined the beach, each of them as luxurious and appealing as pearls on a string.
"I'm dying to stay here," she said,
then instantly regretted it. The champagne had gone right to her head.
"Guess you'll have to wait for your banker to come back," Mick said.
"Guess so," she said lightly.
Mick dipped a fritter in aioli and let the topic go. Maybe he was consciously avoiding a fight, or maybe he wasn't as jealous as he'd claimed to be. Maybe he was content to let the past be the past. Maybe he thought Baker Steele would never return to St. John. Maybe he thought he and Ayers could just continue their relationship where they'd left off, as though neither Baker nor Bridget had ever existed. Ayers wasn't so sure. Huck leads Ayers to Rosie's room and opens the door. Ayers has been in Rosie's room only twice before, both times years ago. The first time was when they swung by after work, so Rosie could change before they went dancing at Castaways. The other time, Rosie was at work and Ayers was off, and Rosie had texted Ayers and begged her to grab her bottle of Percocet. She had just had all 4 wisdom teeth removed and was crying in pain. But that was it. They were grown women. They hung out in bars, not in each other's bedrooms. Ayers remembers, however, that while the rest of the house looked like it was shared by the protagonist of The Old Man and the Sea and The Little Mermaid, Huck and Maya, Rosie's room was a sanctuary, cool and elegant, and it still is. The wallpaper is printed with pink hibiscus blossoms, and the hibiscus theme is echoed by a bush outside the open window. The queen-size bed has at least a dozen pillows artfully arranged against the rattan headboard. Rosie was a fastidious bedmaker, whereas Ayers sleeps in a tangle of sheets every night and sees absolutely no point in making a bed that she's only going to climb right back into the next night. Ayers gets a sudden vision of Rosie folding napkins at La Tapa. She was careful and precise in the task, like she was doing origami. Against the wall is a large teak bureau. Over it hangs a giant round silver-framed mirror. The door to the closet is closed tight. The only personal touches that Ayers can see are a trio of framed photographs in one corner and a copy of Jane Eyre on the nightstand. Rosie was a sucker for the classics, especially the novels of Edith Wharton, George Eliot, and the Bronte sisters, and it was nearly impossible to get her to read anything contemporary, though she and Ayers had made a deal. Ayers would read Middlemarch if Rosie would read Eat, Pray, Love. Ayers hadn't kept her end of the bargain, which she feels awful about now. Huck asked Ayers to help him go through Rosie's things, but it's clear he hasn't been in here even once, and Ayers suspects Maya hasn't either. It's undisturbed, as if Rosie might walk back in at any moment, straw market bag over her shoulder, singing Aretha Franklin. That probably is the point. If they go through everything and sort out what to keep and what to throw away, they're admitting Rosie is gone.
"I'll get started, I guess," Ayers says to Huck. "I'll make four piles, to keep, to give away, to throw away, and undecided."
"Ayers," Huck says. She turns to him. She's afraid he's going to break down, and if he breaks down, she will too. They both vowed to be strong for Maya, and they have been, but this hasn't left a lot of time for them to tend to their own grief. Ayers can practically hear the texture and timbre of Rosie's voice. "You make me feel like a natural woman."
"Last Friday," Huck says. "The FBI called."
Ayers snaps back to reality.
"Virgin Islands Search and Rescue contacted them about the wreckage. The agent I spoke to said it looks like there might have been foul play."
Ayers nods but says nothing. After she and Mick had left Keneal Bay and returned the inflatable dinghy, they'd continued on to Joe's Rum Hut for happy hour. Then they stopped at Woody's for a drink. Then they strolled down to Morgan's Mango to have dinner. By that time, Mick was drunk enough to engage in some pretty wild theorizing.
"The bird Rosie was on did not go down by accident," Mick had said. "I guarantee you that." "Turns out the damage to the helicopter wasn't consistent with a lightning strike," Huck says. "They think there might have been a bomb aboard, or that maybe someone tampered with the wiring to cause an explosion."
Ayers blinks.
"I just thought you should know," Huck says. "They're still investigating."
"Maya?"
"I didn't tell her," Huck says. "The less she thinks about the actual crash, the better."
"Agreed," Ayers says. "What about, I mean, do we know if—"
She swallows. "Have you heard from Irene?"
"I made her promise she would text me once she made it home," Huck says, "and she did. Then, a day or two later, she texted to let me know that her mother-in-law, Russ's mother, had passed away. Which, I guess, was something of a blessing. Though I don't know, that's a lot of loss for 1 week. I sent my condolences, then decided I'd leave her be for a while. So I'm not sure if she knows about this, though I assume so. Have you heard from the boys?"
Ayers has not, which bothers her more than it probably should, especially since she told both Baker and Cash to leave her alone. She was disappointed that they had lied to her about who they were, and besides that, she was back together with Mick. There was no reason for either of them to reach out to her, but their silence chafes nonetheless. They had both claimed to have feelings for her. Baker used the phrase, love at first sight, and Cash said he thought he was in love with her. But now that they're back in America living their lives, Ayers has been forgotten. Which is why she never dates tourists. She is especially peeved at Cash, because she had texted him the day before with a link to a job opening on Treasure Island. Wade, the first mate, was moving back to the States to manage a marijuana dispensary outside of Boston, and they needed to hire a replacement before he left in 2 weeks. Skip, the bartender at La Tapa, had expressed interest, but Ayers didn't think she could handle dealing with Skip at both of her places of employment, and she suspects that James, the captain, would throw Skip overboard before they made it into British waters. The problem is that everyone on St. John already has a job, and anyone who's not on St. John doesn't have housing. Then Ayers thought of Cash. He had been a big help on that trip to Virgin Gorda, and he'd had years of experience as a ski instructor, which, as he pointed out, was exactly the same thing, only completely different. He's probably certified in CPR. He would have to get his life-saving certificate, take a marine safety class, and literally learn the ropes. But all of that stuff is easy. The most attractive thing about Cash, other than his charm and love of the outdoors, is that he has a place to live. Maybe it was a bit of a stretch to imagine that Cash would drop everything and move to the Virgin Islands in order to crew on Treasure Island. Maybe he thought Ayers was teasing him or taunting him, but if so, wouldn't he have shot back a snappy response? Not a word, Ayers tells Huck. She tries to make this sound like a good thing, but he must know better, because he pats her shoulder.
Holler when you get hungry, Huck says. I'll bring you some lunch.
Great, Ayers says weakly. She thinks of the awful fish sandwiches on buttered Wonder Bread that Huck packs for Maya.
I'm picking up barbecue from Candy's, he says, and Ayers perks up. Thank you for doing this.
He casts his eyes upward.
I'm sure Rosie would prefer to have you discovering her secrets rather than me.
Discovering her secrets makes the work sound intriguing when, in fact, it's merely heartbreaking. Ayers starts with a closet. Rosie loved to wear white. It made her skin look luminous. The clothes in the right half of the closet are all white. Shades of eggshell, ivory, ecru, and pearl mix with the most blinding of whites. Everything is crisp and ironed, even her jeans. The clothes in the left half of the closet are full of color. Rosie's bright printed handkerchief halters, her bohemian blouses, her simple cotton tank dresses. Nobody rocked a Jersey patio dress like Rosie Small. Ayers' favorite is a ribbed cotton racerback in brilliant marigold. She fingers it, remembering some special occasion at Chateau Bordeaux. The two of them had gone for cocktails to enjoy the spectacular view over Coral Bay, and Rosie had been wearing that dress. Beneath the clothes are shoes, sandals, wedges, and the pair of black Dansko clogs marked with green tape that Rosie wore when she waited tables at La Tapa. Ayers inhales through her nose, trying to stave off the tears. Everyone at La Tapa wore black clogs, and on Ayers' very first day of work, Rosie had advised making hers distinguishable in some way. She showed Ayers the green tape.
Looks like we wear about the same size, Rosie said, but if I ever see these on your feet, I'll cut you. Hear?
Ayers could take the clogs now, of course, and wear them as a tribute. But is she worthy? Rosie was hands down the best server at La Tapa, the best server on the island, period. The guests clamored for her. Her name was mentioned something like 117 times on TripAdvisor. Ayers would also like the marigold dress and all of the pristine white jeans. The handkerchief halters are so quintessentially Rosie that Ayers can only imagine giving them to Maya to wear when she's older. Much older. Ayers throws herself down on the bed. She'd look awful in the yellow dress. But maybe she'll take it anyway and hang it in her closet, a reminder of her beautiful friend. Foul play. The FBI. Russell Steele was into something illegal. He had enemies. Someone wanted him dead, and Rosie was collateral damage. Ayers pushes herself up and goes to the corner to study the photographs. The top is a photo of Rosie with Leanne and Huck. Rosie is wearing a white cap and gown. It's her graduation from the University of the Virgin Islands on St. Thomas. Huck looks pretty much the same as he does now, maybe a few pounds lighter then, with a bit more red in his beard. Ayers studies Leanne, Rosie's mother. She was tall and statuesque and wore her reddish-brown hair in a braided topknot. Ayers had heard all about the glamorous Leanne, that she had modeled as a teenager and gotten as far away as the fashion shows in Milan, but had come home to marry her childhood sweetheart, Levi Small, who'd ended up leaving the island for good shortly after Rosie was born. Leanne had then gone to school to become a nurse practitioner. To hear some people tell it, Leanne was the most qualified caregiver at the Myra Keating Smith Community Health Center, even better than the doctors. Ayers had found Leanne intimidating, initially anyway. She exuded competence as well as something Ayers could only describe as a regal bearing. When Leanne first met Ayers, she'd seemed disapproving that Ayers had no college degree and no way to support herself other than the hand-to-mouth existence that waiting tables afforded.
"Don't your parents want more for you?" Leanne had asked.
Ayers had tried to explain that her parents were wanderers without a home, without possessions, really, and that they counted wealth by life experiences. Leanne had met this news with a skeptical arched eyebrow.
"Don't you want more for yourself?" Leanne asked.
Ayers had shrugged. She was 22 years old at the time. But it was Leanne Power's questions that led Ayers to get her second, slightly more professional job on Treasure Island. After that, Leanne's opinion of her had seemed to improve.
"Learn everything you can about the business," Leanne said, "then save your money and buy it."
Leanne had been even tougher when dealing with Rosie. The worst insult Leanne could dish out was to say that Rosie took after her small relatives. That look in Rosie's eyes, for example, that fire, that defiance, was pure Small, Leanne said, and it had to be contained, or the girl would ruin herself. What would Leanne have made of the invisible man? Nothing good, Ayers guesses. Ayers hadn't said this out loud to anyone, but she doesn't think it's a coincidence that Russell Steele, the invisible man, reappeared in Rosie's life just after Leanne died. A few weeks ago, Ayers had learned that Russ was Maya's father, meaning he had been in Rosie's life a lot longer than anyone knew. Oh, how Ayers longs to ask Rosie herself.
"You could have told me everything," Ayers thinks. "I was a safe place for you."
The center photo is of Maya, taken outside the Gift Hill School. She's very small, wearing a backpack that is nearly as big as she is, and in the photo she's on her tiptoes, reaching for the latch of the fence to let herself in. The picture is precious, and Ayers can imagine Rosie in the parking lot, possibly crouched down between two cars so Maya wouldn't see her, capturing this early expression of independence. Maya's relationship with Rosie had been less contentious than Rosie's with Leanne, but that's not to say it was all milk and cookies after school and snuggles and stories at bedtime. There was a ferocity that ran through the female line of that family. Maybe Leanne, Rosie, and Maya were all too similar, and Ayers had seen Rosie and Maya butt heads again and again. When Ayers was called on to referee, she usually sided with Maya, causing Maya to utter the famous line that Ayers was like a mother to her, but better, because she wasn't her mother. The third photograph is of Rosie and Ayers on Oppenheimer Beach, back when the tire swing still hung from the crooked palm that stretched out over the water. The tire swing was more fun to look at than actually ride on, as Ayers had learned the hard way, but this picture of the two of them in bikinis is the best picture of them ever taken. Ayers keeps the same photo on her phone as her screensaver, and she will never replace it. She feels honored that she has earned a spot on Rosie's bedroom wall. It seems to mean that Rosie considered her family. Ayers can't help but notice that there is no picture of Russell Steele on the wall. If there are secrets to discover, Ayers predicts she'll find them in the top drawer of the dresser. That's where people put intimate things, right? Women their lingerie, and men their condoms. Rosie's top drawer holds the expected collection of bras and panties, some functional, some recreational, as well as teddies and slips, cotton socks, a box of tampons, two full carousels of birth control pills, and a plastic bag containing six tightly rolled joints, which Ayers slips right into her purse. Rosie would definitely want Ayers to take those so Maya doesn't find them and get thoughts about experimenting. The middle drawer is a jumble of bikinis, nearly all of which Ayers recognizes. At least half a dozen are white. The rest are black, red, blue gingham, Kelly green with hot pink piping. There's a pink smocked top that Ayers loves. And then she remembers a super cool turquoise crocheted bikini that Rosie got from La Tarte. Ayers digs for it, but it's not there. Maybe Rosie wore it to Anagata? A sobering thought. Then Ayers finds something intriguing. Beneath the bikinis is a layer of cloth-bound books. But they're not books, Ayers realizes when she opens one and sees Rosie's handwriting. They're journals. Ayers extracts the journals like she's unearthing the bones of ancient peoples on an archaeological dig. Ayers reads from the one on top. January 1st, 2000. It's not only a new century, but a new millennium. I, Rosalie Veronica Small, am 17 years old, a senior at Charlotte Amalie High School. I'm in love with Oscar Cobb, and nothing my mother or Huck can say will keep us from getting married on my 18th birthday. Ayers shuts that journal and scrambles for one closer to the bottom of the pile from 2015. Ayers's breathing is shallow. January 1st, 2015. R has stayed in Iowa through the holidays because his older son is visiting from Houston with his new baby. I wanted to text him a picture of me and Ayers doing tequila slammers up at the banana deck, but of course the rule is no texting. Ayers closes the journal, then her eyes. Tequila slammers at the banana deck, New Year's Eve, 4 years earlier. Yes, they had stopped there after the end of service at La Tapa, but before they went to the beach bar to dance to Miss Fairchild. It had been a fun night, recklessly wild. They had closed the beach bar, gotten high, skinny-dipped in Frank Bay, then crashed a party all the way out on Ironwood Road in Coral Bay and stayed up to watch the sunrise. Ayers knew then about the invisible man, but he was just some guy who showed up every now and then to wine and dine Rosie and give her lavish presents. If Ayers is remembering correctly, it was right after that New Year's that Rosie got a new Jeep, a four-door Wrangler in stingray gray with all the bells and whistles. Whose is that? Ayers had asked when Rosie pulled up in it. Mine, Rosie said without another word of explanation. Ayers had known then that it was from the lover, the invisible man, and that was when Ayers started to wonder just how serious that relationship was. Ayers turns around to make sure the bedroom door is closed. How is she going to smuggle the journals out of there? If there's any question as to whether she's the right person to read them first, she pushes it aside. God only knows what kind of details they contain. Ayers can't risk letting Maya read them before she does. And Huck made his feelings clear. Despite this, Ayers doesn't want to tell Huck she's found them. Why? Well, she's not sure why. It's just a gut instinct. What if curiosity or ego gets the best of Huck and he decides to read them himself? Ayers can practically hear Rosie saying, "No!" Ayers looks under the bed and on the floor of the closet for a duffel or a suitcase, but finds nothing. Then she hears a car and peeks out the window to see Huck pulling out of the driveway. He must be on his way to get lunch from Candy's. Perfect. Ayers heads out to the kitchen and pulls a reusable shopping bag off the hook next to the sink. She loads the journals up and hurries them out to Edith, her truck. She throws a beach towel over them for good measure. She goes back to Rosie's room, replaces all the bikinis, and shuts the drawer. She sits on the floor. She's short of breath. She has discovered all of Rosie's secrets. They're waiting like a time bomb in Ayers's truck. A few minutes later, Ayers hears the front door open and then Huck calling out, "Grub, come and get it." Ayers is too keyed up to eat. She wants to get home and read the journals. She's going to have to hide them somewhere Mick won't find them or see her reading them. Huck knocks on the bedroom door and swings it open just as Ayers pulls out the third dresser drawer, so they both see what's inside at exactly the same time. Ayers shrieks. Huck says, "What the hell is that?" It's money. The bottom drawer is filled with money. Cash. He's having dinner with his mother at the Pullman Bar and Diner when she asks the question he's been dreading. "So, what's next for you? Back to the mountains?"
"Trying to get rid of me already?" he says.
"Not at all," Irene says. "It's just that I thought this..." She indicates the restaurant and their server, Ryan, whom she seems to be on pretty familiar terms with, "was the stuff of your nightmares, stuck in Iowa City, eating the early bird special with your mother."
"It's only been 5 days," Cash says.
"And Millie is handled," Irene says. "I don't mean to make your grandmother sound like a loathsome errand, but I also want you to know that you don't need to stay here on my account. Surely you have better things to do than listen to me describe my crazy dreams." His mother is right. Cash should load Winnie into his truck and return to Denver to clean up what's left of his life there before he heads to Breckenridge for the remainder of the winter. But what had seemed so appealing before he got Irene's phone call informing him his father was dead has lost its luster. He received no fewer than 10 panicked voicemails from Dylan, the manager of Cash's Belmar store, asking why there are chains on the door and why no one is answering the phone at the Cherry Creek store. Cash finally responded, "Business went under. I would offer you a reference, but I know you've been skimming from the register. Sorry, bro. Good luck out there." Cash is 2 payments behind on his truck, so he needs a job right away. But because it's already January, all of the positions at the ski school have been filled. Cash called his buddy Jay, and he said Cash could sleep on his sofa for a week, but that would be all his new girlfriend would tolerate, and finding other housing at this point would be tricky, especially with a dog.
"You might want to cool your heels there," Jay said, "and try coming out in March when everyone else gets cabin fever and leaves."
Cool his heels in Iowa for 2 months? In winter? There's no way he can do it, can he? And yet, what choice does he have? Living with Irene is free, the house is comfortable and plenty big enough, and Irene gives him 20s and 50s every time he goes out. She would probably make his car payment in exchange for him doing some simple handyman work. But would his morale survive? He fears not. Earlier that day, his mother pressed $200 into his hand and sent him to the Hy-Vee for groceries, which he didn't object to as he needed dog food for Winnie and some shaving cream for himself. And who should he run into at the deli counter but his high school girlfriend, Claire Bellows, the one who went to Northwestern and promptly slept with Baker?
"Cash?"
Claire said, blinking like he was an apparition.
"Cash Steele? Is that you?"
Cash forced a smile while he cursed his truly terrible luck. And yet, this was what happened when you returned to your hometown. You bumped into the people you used to know. Claire Bellows looked basically the same, maybe a little older, maybe a little washed out. Her face was wan, her hair colorless and pulled back into a sad little bun.
She was pushing a cart that held two children, a toddler who was standing up among the groceries, his left foot perilously close to a carton of eggs, and a baby in a bucket seat that snapped onto the